That's the CBC Radio News, and looking at the weather for today, people have been talking and dreaming of white Christmases, and there may be one in the future, because it looks as if tonight we're going to get a fair bit of snow for parts of Nova Scotia anyway, for Halifax and vicinity, Eastern Shore, Central Nova Scotia, and Northern Nova Scotia, Pictou and Antigonish counties. There will be about 5 to 10 centimeters of snow on the way. For the Valley and South Shore, Cumberland and Colchester counties, probably only 2 to 5 centimeters expected overnight tonight. During the day today, just cloudy skies, the winds diminishing, and temperatures lowering to about 2 degrees by this afternoon. It is already 2 degrees here in Halifax.
In Pointe aux Lacs this morning, according to the ham radio operators, they're already seeing snow, so they're getting a little advanced preview in some parts of Nova Scotia already this morning. If it's true in Church Point, I'm sure it's true elsewhere.
This could be true.
Doing things a little bit differently this morning. As you noticed, Elizabeth was not speaking with the weather office. We're going to dispense with the sportscast altogether. We'll tell you in the next hour who won the NHL games. Not much going on anyway, because we wanted to make allowances to bring you a special story which we think is sort of appropriate to the season.
It is, in fact. It's a special documentary that Kelly Ryan has been working on for the last month. It's about the Fisher King of Dartmouth. Now, to some, a crazy old man or a street bum. His long black coat was tattered. His long white hair hung in ribbons around his chiseled face. And he spoke in what seemed to be riddles. But to others, he was a mystic, a poet, an angel. His name was Garrett Dean. He was found dead in his Dartmouth home over a month ago. He was 86. And though few knew him in life, his story has a magic that carries on even after his death. Kelly Ryan has the story of a treasure most never discovered.
And this is Garrett's house. You've seen Garrett's house? And it's an extraordinary thing to come up to Garrett's front door. All the tangled kind of garden and web all around the front door. And seeing that kind of fabric behind the windows, the sort of Victorian look to it. There's an angel in the door here in the window. It says, side door, go there.
Bye. Is it really? Is it true? Is it a dream?
Gareth Dean's house. A mirror of the man inside. Its windows dark and frightening, yet intriguing. An angel's image hung on the door. The house a source of rumors, much like the man himself. Renee Forrestal, daughter of artist Tom, remembers when she was 13. She and her friends stood across from that massive house in downtown Dartmouth and whispered about the man inside.
I didn't know him. They didn't know him. But they said to me, "You see that house over there? It's haunted." They said there's strange things that go on in that house. One of them said, "Oh, yes, I saw flames in the window." And they were making it all sound very mysterious. And I said, "Nah, no way." I'd always look at the front door because he had, there was a large window on the door, and then on either side of the door, a number of panes of glass. And there was a little postcard or a picture of an angel or a saint holding a lamb. And when I saw the angel holding the lamb, I thought, there's no way this house is haunted, or there's no way it's a bad place, it's a good place.
Renee was captured, enraptured by the angel. She walked by it, stared at it for years. Finally, when she was 18, she knocked on the door. An old man with long hair answered. He asked her why she was disturbing his writing, and if she was an artist. When she said yes, he invited her in.
I think for that whole summer, I spent every day or every second day, or I spent almost all the summer with him that year. And because he was completely magic, and he loved me right away, and I was in love with him, you know, in that sort of way that I think he brought magic to my life.
Ask, who was Garrett Dean? And you'll get as many different answers as people you ask. To Renee Forrestal, he was an angel. To those like Brian Doucette, who works downtown and saw him walk the streets, he was far less.
I'd say eccentric. I don't know. I'd say he was crazy, too, 86 years old. But you never seen him down here?
No, I don't think so. Don't know. I mean, I might have.
Really hunched down. He would just walk like this. All old, black old clothes on, yeah. Long old hair. Eccentric.
That was Garrett Dean on the surface. Scratch that surface just a little, and you'll find a man who was a model in New York in the 1920s, who performed on Broadway in the 30s, who ran an antique store in New York in the 40s and 50s, and who came home to Nova Scotia to find his mother dead in her bedroom. He stayed in the family home in Dartmouth after that, a source of much talk to neighbors who found his ways strange and sometimes frightening. His friends Sue Bone and Jovanna Roach remember.
When you see Garrett, he looks frightful to people. He looks like a cross between Howard Hughes in his last days and Oscar Wilde. You know, he's so extraordinary. But when he looks at you with his eyes, they're so pure and so blue, they just knock your socks right off. It looks like you're staring into the eyes of an angel.
Garrett was never, ever dirty. He was a very clean man. But his clothes were from the 20s. And he wore his hair somewhat long. And so, therefore, he was judged by that. He was judged by his outward appearance. He was judged by the way he spoke, which was always brilliant. But then again, in poetical terms and in mystical terms, he was thought to be imbalanced. If they had have taken 1 minute, you know, of their time to look and hear or listen, and he used to say all the time, "Eyes and they see not, Jovanna, ears and they hear not." And that was the case in Dartmouth. It was eyes and they saw not, ears and they heard not. And they missed a great deal. They missed a lot.
His friends say they missed a mystic, a poet, an angel. The only way to tell his story is to hear the memories of his friends, those few who looked beyond the eccentricities to the soul beneath, to hear the poems that he cherished and refused to allow published because he didn't want fame and fortune, and to hear his voice recorded by one friend who felt even Garrett's casual conversation was poetry.
The lyrics to me are almost, I see in them things, the eyes of the lilacs. And, I think I could live in lilacs and be drunk forever with lilacs, intoxicated with them day and night, night and day, and never leave them.
There were once lilacs around Garrett's house, the house that is empty now, boarded up with signs warning trespassers away, once hosted magnificent midnight dinners. Renee Forrestal still recalls one. She was 18, and her parents realized who she was visiting on the corner of Queen and Dundas Streets, the man most deemed to be crazy.
He'd often have dinners late at night, like between, well, dinner would start around 9. You'd go down, and, you know, and then he'd start putting the turkey on at 9 o'clock. And it was lovely. We had a guest with us, and Garrett had the fire going in the dining room, and beautiful roast turkey was being prepared with all the trimmings and homemade ice cream. And Garrett was playing the Ave Maria on his old phonograph. And we were having a lovely time, and a knock came at the door really hard. And so Garrett went out, and I could hear the voices, and I thought, oh, no. I thought, it's my parents. And I thought, oh, no. And then I could hear Garrett's voice sort of defending me. And Garrett was saying things like, oh, you know, if you believed in your daughter as much as I do in her art, you would set her up in her own studio. And he had my parents on their knees.
I just don't relate, that's all. Only to artists, really, and people of the field of the art.
Garrett Dean's art was his poetry. He wrote it everywhere. On envelopes, on scraps of paper, on loose leaf. He wrote every day. He wrote sonnets to Greta Garbo, rhymes about rivers, and some manuscripts he kept in a safe deposit box in his bank.
And that is in the vault. And what worries me about my writings, I haven't looked at them for years, will they fade because I'll never, never be able to bring them back? Because it was only at the moment I did it. Because, you see, I don't study. I do things extempore. My whole nature is that way.
They were lovely poems. They seemed like they were almost written for children, but they appealed so to every human need of security and warmth.
In childhood, I said, why? You know, how do I know I live? How do I know I do? Well, only I know the joy is the beautiful twin of dew. How do I know at her mirrors love will always say, oh, to be but a child, and to always play.
The one I think of that I used to call and ask him to read to me was called O House, or it began, O House That I'll Build Tomorrow, Far Up on the Hill. And I don't remember the rest of it.
I will build a house tomorrow, far from the lonely tides, high on a hill where only summer's roses hide. The walls all timber with memory, and the roof with many a star, and the windows of pale silence brought from afar. There they will never harm you, nor hurt your little feet. You'll run the lines of laughter, and with love you'll sleep. Oh, house that I'll build tomorrow, far from the lonely tide, high on that hill, where the rose's eyes will never close, and I will never, and I will always hide tomorrow.
The script is so elaborate and so beautiful that sometimes it's difficult to decipher, but this one I remember thinking, oh, it's so clear, and I had no problem right away reading it. I'll read it now. Wanting only what's there, and never to look at anything else again. Not even the spring in all her green. Not even the sky in all her blue. And who is this? From whence and where have they come? Knowing they'll never return to that whence, to that where. Here they will stay. And they will say, we have found our one. This we will hold. This we will keep. Garrett Dean.
Bob Dean, no relation to Garrett, is the friend who recorded Garrett over the phone. Bob lives in New York, and he wants to publish Garrett's works.
He was the most amazing poet in that sense, that he could work your whole body and massage you with his words. I felt I met the greatest poet, the Homer of the 20th century in Garrett. And not just a poet, but a person who surprised you constantly. And also the way he was so generous with his home and with people. I met people in his home that I would never meet anywhere else in society. I would probably be snobbish, or I would feel inferior, depending on who they were. But with Garrett, he was a great leveler, and everybody became unique and warm in his presence.
Garrett entertained the rich and the poor, the lawyers and the homeless. It was another form of art. He said it was greater to live poetry than to write it. But living poetry takes its toll. Priorities are different. The way you see the world is different. Father Eric Thériault gave the eulogy at his friend's funeral. He says Garrett Dean suffered in life because he was the true artist.
For me, the artist is one who has been given a very special gift from God, and it becomes, it's an obsession to discover as perfectly as they're capable of beauty and truth. And that is the motivating force in their whole lives. And I think Garrett was one of those. So that the true artist is really a mystic. They are people who live in the presence of the Almighty. It really, if you were a fanatic about living the gospel, the true sense of the gospel about, you know, blessed are the meek and blessed are the poor in spirit and this type of thing, you'd come close to describing Garrett Dean.
Giovanna Roach, longtime friend of Garrett's, agrees.
He certainly was a mystic. He certainly was a poet. And he certainly was an angel. If people want proof of these things, when I was a young woman, I used to follow Garrett. I used to walk with him wherever he wanted to go, and sometimes it would be late at night. And I wouldn't dare do the things that I did with him today. I was fearless. I was totally fearless with him. It was as if we had an army behind us, and we would go into these back streets and be bringing cookies or cakes or food to the most poverty-stricken, hopeless, lost people. And he would go into their little rooms, and I would go with him. And he would bring these things, and he would start telling them how absolutely wonderful they were. And, oh, how cozy it was here. And, oh, you are so wonderful. And he would uplift these people until these people, eventually, after, say, 20 minutes of the visit, these people would start to exude what Garrett was saying to them. They would start to light up. They would shine. And I'm talking about, you know, a place with a chair and a bed, a place that was cold. He made it warm. He made them warm. That's the part of him, I think, that is the angel.
An angel? Then an angel abused in a world that didn't know how to treat him, was frightened by his way, his looks, his words. Kids threw rocks at him and his house. They broke his windows. They challenged his safety, damaged his home. But it wasn't only kids who spurned him.
There's a story of him going into a bank because of the way he was dressed. People looked at him, and anyway, his turn came up, and he got to the teller, and he put his check down in front of him, and he said, "I'd like to cash my check, please." And she said, she looked at it, and she said, "Just a minute, Mr. Dean." And she turned around, and she went over to see somebody at a desk, and they looked at the check, and they kind of peered over. They looked at Garrett, and then they took the check, and they walked away with it, and they went behind another window, and somebody else, they passed it in. Somebody looked at the check, peered out at Garrett, and then they took the check, and they went in to the manager. And on it went like this, and the manager, he finally peered out, looked at Garrett, and he sort of gave it back to the teller, and she came back to Garrett, and she says, "Yes, Mr. Dean, we will cash your check." And Garrett took the check from her hand, and he said, "Oh, no, you won't, madam. I would rather leave you with your suspicions."
But also an angel with a sense of humor.
I remember one time we were walking down the street. We were standing at a red light, a crosswalk, and some people came up, and they looked at him. They just sort of gasped. And then Garrett just kind of rolled his eyes, and then he put on an act as if he was completely crazy. And he sort of went, blah, 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 blah. And then they just looked at him. They were so terrified. And I was just cracking up. And they went dashing across the street on this red light, almost killing themselves. It was pretty funny. But this is the kind of reaction. I mean, people would just assume things all the time about who he was, and they had no idea. And I think this happens to a lot of people.
Friends say you either loved Garrett Dean or you were frightened by him. Those who were frightened were often cruel. The world can never make it up to Garrett Dean. He died on November 1st of a heart attack. It was just after Halloween. Friends believe he was on his way to the door to stop kids from throwing rocks at his beloved house. In the days that followed, Garrett's one living relative, a nephew from New Brunswick, cleaned everything out of the house. Brian Doucette was one of the men hired to drag things deemed to be garbage from Garrett's home.
Everything had something to do with furniture. That was his thing, eh?
He sifts through the dumpster that holds his morning's work.
Yeah.
But I mean, this whole house.
Doorknob?
It's just everything. Yeah.
But to Garrett, there was beauty in everything. Even the dust on plastic flowers was important. He called it the patina of old age, significant dust. But those plastic flowers and so much else were carelessly stuffed into that dumpster. The nephew, Alexander Morrison, didn't know him well. friends had to fight to keep the writings safe. They were allowed to go into the house to gather them all. The poems are now being held in a state until a decision on what to do with them is made. Alexander Morrison doesn't understand the fuss. He wouldn't talk about his uncle, but his wife shouted her feelings from inside the house. She just read the death notice that referred to Garrett's poetry and talent.
So there's some artists in the community who think that he was important, so...
They're artists. They're also priests. Father Eric Terrio.
It's probably a good thing that Garrett didn't have many close friends who were psychiatrists, because he would have ended up at the NS, you know.
Sure. Well, they'd have certified him, because, we in our society, we'll only tolerate so much, you know, that's different. If you ask Garrett Dean if he ever saw angels, I suspect he would say yes.
Do you think that he was mentally ill?
No, I don't. I think he was saying more sane than I am. But he was different, you know, and surely, you know, if you're different enough, somebody's going to call you crazy.
No matter what the world thought, Garrett's friends felt his life was worthy of a wistful tribute, the kind befitting a mystic, a poet, an angel. Neighbor Bruce Hilton describes how friends strew flowers over the house Garrett cherished.
They were all stuck in the storm window, the little loops in the storm windows that they bolted on. There's still some up here in the old vine. See it? They had them all the way along the veranda.
Flowers.
See the flowers?
Yeah.
They had them all strewn along the veranda for them.
That must have been quite a sight when it was covered with flowers.
Oh, yeah. Well, they had that, and they had, like, every little eyelet in the screws that hold the storm windows, they had them stuffed through there and everything, yeah.
As his friends sit in their own homes, sort through their own pictures, they speak of him with triumph. Sue Bone calls life a tight shoe, which Garrett Dean has finally been allowed to take off. Giovanna Roach says he won over all those who tried to kill the beauty in him. She goes to her stereo and puts on Garrett Dean's favorite song, Edith Piaf, No Regrets. She says he used to listen to it with tears in his eyes, overcome with sympathy for the life Edith Piaf lived, a life that in many ways echoed his own. And as Edith Piaf's songs still live, so do Garrett Dean's words, at least for those who took the time to treasure them.
He would say, Giovanna, come ye forth and stand ye apart in your thinking, and be strong enough to stand on your own. And the other thing he taught me was,
sometimes perhaps it's greater to live poetry than write it.
Greater to live poetry than it was to write it.
Different can be so beautiful.
It's interesting, too, because I remember seeing the obituary in the Chronicle Herald. I had never heard of Garrett Dean, but I read that obituary and said, it's an amazing guy. Regardless of how you view it, an amazing guy, and answered an awful lot of questions. Kelly's piece answered a lot of questions were brought forward by the obituary.
And thanks so much to Kelly Ryan for preparing that documentary.
Appropriate to this evening in lots of ways.
It certainly
depends
is.
Depends on how you look at it. You have a quick look at the weather, maybe?
We have for today some clouds around Nova Scotia. There is a winter storm advisory issued for parts of the province for tonight for Halifax and vicinity, the Eastern Shore, central Nova Scotia, Pictou and Antigonish counties, and that means between 5 and 10 centimeters of snow for tonight. If you are planning to do some traveling, you might want to get on the way before this evening. It is going to be about 2 degrees during the day today.
It is 8 o'clock. The news is next.
It's quite a day. Sunny. I saw a nice view of the city from the Empire State Building.
Well, I'm glad we could provide that. We got the tape rolling here. So let me just start by asking you how you first met Garrett Dean.
I first met him in the spring of 69, where a neighbor, friend of mine from high school, thought I should meet him. So I went to his door, and after a while he came to it. And within 5 minutes, he suggested that I was probably a really good dancer, which was true, but he didn't know that. And that's my first meeting. Then I went away, and when I came back to Dartmouth 2 years later, I think it was Thanksgiving weekend in 1971, the same friend told me to go over and see Garrett. So we knocked on the door, and after a while he opened it. He always checked to see who was there first, and then if he wanted you, you got in. And we stood in the hallway for about half an hour, and he talked to us in the distance from, you know, from the other end of the hallway. And then we passed that test, so then we were invited into his kitchen, and I spent the next 5 hours being massaged by an oral bath and shower that I had never experienced before.
Tell me about it. I mean, what do you mean when you say that?
Well, did you hear the tape that Sue gave you?
I listened to a little bit of it. I didn't listen to much of it because I was in such a grumpy mood. I figured it wasn't the right state of mind.
Right. Well, Garrett, what was interesting was that when you went into his house, and once you get into the kitchen and you sat down, there was such a unique atmosphere because it had, he had an old stove. It was like almost like a log cabin, but, you know, with porcelain walls, though. It was the early 20th century. But the way he started to talk about anything, his voice, probably because of his theatrical career, just sort of enveloped you into a warm envelope, and you just got swept away. And he also paid a lot of attention to what you'd say, but you could never predict how he'd interpret what you said. And then eventually he would rename you. If you when you listen to that interview, the person he's talking to is, I shouldn't say interview, conversation, is named Jerry, but I think pretty soon in the conversation he decides to call him Fidalgo. And so one got christened with a new name, and you were forever known as that.
What was your name?
Roberto, which wasn't, you know, quite different from my name, Bob, but that's what he came up with. Whereas Sue Bone, who you've met, was known as Suvanna, and another woman who I only know as Giovanna now. I forget her original name. I don't think it was anything like Giovanna. Those are examples.
It all sounds very, I don't know, kind of bizarre. I mean, was it a comfortable feeling?
Oh, yeah. That's what was very amazing about the man, is that he made you feel so warm. You'd feel it in your heart. And I think whatever it is his heart chakra is so open, or whatever you want to term that chemistry, that you'd immediately pick it up. And he would compliment you. He'd find something, he'd figure out something about your characteristic that he would exaggerate as if and inflate it, as if it's the most important characteristic that one could ever have, and that you were the only one in the world that had it. So while he did a kind of narcissistic talk about his own life, he also brought you into it and made you seem to be the most significant person he ever met. And through the years, as I met him, I met other people through him and saw them go through this initiation, they'd all feel the same thing. They felt like they met their the most intimate lover they could ever get from either side, either sex.
That's quite the statement.
Yeah, but he never, as far as I know, he never seduced anybody or got involved with anybody sexually.
It was just words.
That's right. He was the most amazing poet in that sense, that he could work your whole body and massage you with his words. I always remember once, early in 71, 72, he called my apartment, and he spoke on the phone, and I had a friend who was sitting, say, 20 feet, 30 feet away in the other part of the room, and he could hear every word coming through the receiver, the telephone receiver, yet for me, it was not uncomfortable. He was not screaming in the phone. He had this incredible projection.
What do you know about his career on Broadway?
I don't know much. He kept that really secret. Actually, confidentially, I have checked with several mediums, and they named several plays that he played in. One, if you want to check it out, I've tried at the Dalhousie Library. He played in She Stoops to Conquer in 1946, but I see no record of it in the index of reviews. Maybe they don't cover everything in those index. But he talked a lot about people he acted with. He named a lot of people, and but he never talked about what he was in particularly. And there are a few older people that knew him in New York, and they will tell you that, yes, he was a well-known actor, but he never talked about it in detail, like what plays he did. So I think maybe he exaggerated the frequency of being on Broadway, but that he actually was on Broadway. Because why would Marlon Brando send flowers to his mother's funeral?
He did, eh?
Yeah, that was in 1959. And many people, famous names, as I mentioned in the obituary, often came to see him. And it seems, I would say he had the antique store in the 50s, and he was kind of a legend at that point. So he'd been in New York for 20 years. And he was asked to be in the Eva Legallian Repertory Theater of 1933, and he turned that down. And he said that many of his friends went on to Hollywood. He would have ended up in that route if he'd gone with Eva Legallian. And he kind of suggested he regretted that, but I don't think he really did. I just think he was too individualistic to stay in any group or any one profession, one style of living. Because he would talk about meeting people in New York and walking around New York City, Manhattan, at, say, 6 o'clock in the morning, and walking down the street and then just disappearing into the sky. He'd talk about psychic experiences like that. So whether it was true or not, he made you feel it was real and that it was more important to do that, to have these new encounters with people than to pursue any particular social status.
There are some people around here who think he was just a crazy old man.
Well, he was. That's the thing about Garrett. He was many people. He developed all his different selves. All of us have a crazy side to us or a crazy part to us. He really developed that. I remember him coming up to my apartment in Dartmouth when I lived near him, and through the window of the doorway entering the building, he suddenly put on this manic face at me, and worse than Salvador Dali. It just was so frightening the way he projected his face at me, and he just did it to me. And it was up to me to figure out what to do. And so I just recovered and then let him in, and then it was just a joke. But he would challenge you on that level. Not everybody, but once he got to know you, he'd start to test you. So that would look crazy to someone who was walking down the hall and saw this man do this. But I don't think he was, because he was in control of himself. He just had many characters. I noticed that some of the characters he would play. He would imitate, say, Cape Bretoners or Valley people in Annapolis Valley. Or people from New Brunswick, how he interpreted them. And he would do these characters suddenly on the telephone when he was talking to you. He spent much of his time on the telephone, which I had taped, thankfully. And he would do all these different characters, but move out of them so, and move into maybe talk about philosophy or metaphysics, and then back into a character. So he just flowed. He was like Finnegan's Wake to me. And that I studied Finnegan's Wake with Marshall McLuhan, and I decided that I met Finnegan the way the book is, The Metamorphoses, through Garrett Dean.
Let's talk about the recordings, the tapes that you made.
Yes, back when I moved to Toronto in 77 with my wife, we'd come back for Christmas, say, 79 through to 85. And by 82, 83, I decided I'd see him every Christmas. And so in the early 80s, I decided to take a tape recorder to his home and just place it there in front of him and see what he'd do. I knew from Giovanna that he discouraged any media coverage of himself, any efforts at getting him publicized or even published. But I put it there on the table. He didn't say a word. I got about 4 hours of tape. I switched the tapes and just interrupt the conversation and change the tape, turn them over. This went on for 4 hours, and it wasn't until the end of that 4 hour period, well into the morning, he said, that's a tape recorder, right, Bob? And that was the first time he didn't mind it. And then from then on, I would tape him when he called me. When I went back to Toronto, I had a good system, so I would start taping him from Toronto. And I never told him I was, which is against the law, but I didn't think he'd mind if he found out, but I never told him. And then eventually I started playing them on the radio.
Which is also against the law.
That's right. But with Garrett, you knew you could do anything because he wasn't going to do anything about it.
Is that a good enough reason? He's not going to do anything?
He wouldn't. I knew that I had that kind of understanding of Garrett, that he would not mind, even though I wasn't going to take the risk of telling him.
You must have worried somewhat, then, if you didn't ever tell him.
Well, it was a concern, but I knew. But see, that's the thing with Garrett. Garrett, in a sense, didn't exist. He didn't have any social pressure. He talked about being so free from any social pressures that he couldn't enforce it if it was pressed. You know what I mean? Because he'd be contradicting himself.
I just wonder, though, I mean, you were a friend of his, and obviously, as you said, and I've heard from other people, he didn't want any sort of publicity.
Yeah.
Why, as a friend, you would do that?
Because I took the risk. This was my art form in response to Garrett. I said, okay, Garrett is free to be the way he is. He interprets reality a certain way, and he interacts with people that way. Well, I'm going to do a put-on. I'm going to interpret him a certain way, and have the freedom to violate maybe his privacy and put it on. And I wanted to see what would happen to me if I would get any bad karma from it. And nothing ever happened. And I was really glad I did, because so many people responded to the tapes, and I developed very good conversations with these people, and then I would give them copies. But I never could tell them where Garrett was, because then Garrett would find out. And so that was the mystery that I created around Garrett in Toronto by playing these tapes, and people could only get the tapes, they could never approach Garrett. And so in that sense, I didn't want his privacy violated that way.
So there was a limit to how much you'd violate his privacy.
Yeah, I didn't want him to suffer any effects from it. You know, any publicity or anything that would challenge him or make him be have to add, play some kind of role in relation to a response to the playing of the tapes. So that was where I protected him. So no one ever found him.
Okay, well, let's talk about his poetry, his actual written poetry. Have you read it?
I've gotten many letters from him, and he often wrote his letters very poetically. And sometimes they go into a poetic part, you know, outright poetry, but most time it was just very baroque writing about us or about whatever he wanted to tell us or my wife about his life or what he thought of our life. And so the letters are one thing. I've never seen any of his manuscripts enough to read them, but I've seen them in his kitchen on the table where he would talk about, I was working on a Shakespearean sonnet or something, and there'd be a pile of papers, but I knew I couldn't look at them. He wouldn't let me look at them, but I only saw them. So I never read his poetry until now when I cleaned out his home a few weeks ago in Dartmouth. The manuscripts were put aside by Giovanna, and I looked at them, but I can't say that I... had time to, you know, really get into them, but I will in the future.
Was there a lot there?
Yes, there was a whole trunk full.
A trunk full?
Yes, of bound different kinds of paper, scrap paper, regular loose leaf, whatever he had, he would form a binder of that kind of paper. But there was different kinds of paper, so it was a whole bunch of different binders binders, scribbler kind of binder things. Yeah, not the plastic binders. And so that's what I'm waiting for when the estate gets settled. I know that Giovanna and our friends will be able to go over it, and I'm sure we could interest a publisher. If not, we'll publish it ourselves.
Why do you want to publish it?
Because there are people who are interested in you can't imagine the response you get. I mean, I've had people, and you haven't heard any of the tapes really in detail. I have different tapes that I featured that show Garrett, manic Garrett, you know, quiet Garrett, different kinds of Garrett. And I had people come in, and they'd be listening in the station with me, and they say, that's the voice of God. That's the way God talks, a patriarchal God. And that's how I was amazed at how he could get these inflated responses from people. They really were amazed by him, and they wanted to know more. So I think there's an audience for his written work, because it'll help people visualize what they only heard.
So it's worth a buck.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's worth a buck. And if any of the... I guess the money will go to the estate. I wouldn't do it for money unless something really big happened, and then I'd make a deal with the estate. But I think it goes to his relatives first.
I just wonder, though, because he clearly didn't want people to read his stuff when he was alive. And if he didn't want it read when he was alive, why publish it now that he's dead? Why not respect his wishes?
Oh, I think that he wouldn't mind it being published after. I think Giovanna may know more about that. He never told me that he wanted this published after. But I think that that's the way it was. He decided, and that's why I say in the review, he's an oral bard. He decided in the electric age, and I'm using McLuhan terminology here, that it was an oral poetry one should do, and he did that in life, interacting with people. And visual visual poetry or printed poetry was something that wasn't as powerful as oral interaction, and so it would be left for people to read after he's gone, because he wouldn't be there to be an oral medium to people. So I think that it's almost like print is dead. It's a dead medium, so it's for it's done for posthumous poetry.
Hmm.
So that's a theory. I don't know if you'd agree with it, but that's why I think in a sense he was so involved with his mouth and his body language. And yet he did write, and he talked about it as if it was a serious discipline. He would try to do poetry in different historical styles, but he certainly didn't want the media coverage or the interaction with any kind of fame that came from it. And I think that's a result of his life in New York. He had enough of that. I think that's what was interesting about him. He wanted to create an instantaneous performance kind of poetry with people and interact people directly on their terms and what he could do with his interpretation of what their terms were. That's why I say in the review of his life, in the obituary, that he was one of the first performance artists. I have a friend who knew Garrett in Dartmouth when he occasionally came back in the 50s, and he'd be often walk around Dartmouth with white powder on his face. Now, can you imagine doing that in Dartmouth in 1950? And one time she had to put him in the car because the people on the side were getting a little intimidated by him. Now, that's one part of Garrett. The other part is that he interacted with all levels of society in Halifax, Dartmouth, and some people didn't know that he acted on a performance level like that. in parts of life that they were not aware of. So I think he also was able to be a sane citizen, discuss mortgage issues or whatever he had to do with his bank. On that level, he was a different kind of person with the people that required that kind of talk. So I don't want to emphasize that he was a kook, but I know he used to tell me stories. He'd walk around in Halifax, and I guess he looked like a hobo or something, because often kids would throw rocks at him, and he was just walking along. So, the strength of his personality, his image, or just what he gave off, his aura, had all kinds of responses from people, not always pleasant. Mm. And he generally interacted with Haligonians in the late afternoon and night, early into the next morning. And then he'd walk the bridge back home and sleep until early, say 11 o'clock.
So you think most people in this area have probably seen him, even if they don't know who he is?
Oh, that's right. As a matter of fact, when I was working cleaning out his home and helping move the antiques, all kinds of people came by. There was this old man. He said, I'm 83 years old. And he says, there's a great piano in that house. I went and took piano lessons in that house in 1930, so like 60 years ago. And he says, I don't know the man who lives in there, but I used to like going to that house. That was one response. Another woman came by and said, what happened here? And I said, well, the man who lived here died. He says, I think I used to see him, but once every 6 months. He was a little short man. Now, Garrett was tall. She thought he was short. And so the neighbors all had seen him but didn't know much about him.
There are people here who are very concerned that you want to publish the poems and who are, in fact, going to try and stop you from doing that. Do you know that?
No, I didn't know that, but that's perfectly justified. I mean, I don't have a right to publicize the poetry. I mean, I wouldn't do it. It's a matter of supporting getting a publisher. If someone wants to block it, then that's their business. I have to interact with the people, the relatives, but I'm not going to cause a problem for anybody. If someone else doesn't want to publish it and they have influence with the estate, then that's the way it'll be. It won't get published. So it's something I would like to do, but if it can't be done, then it's not a big problem.
Yeah, their argument is that, if you didn't want them published, we just shouldn't publish them.
Well, yeah, that'll be discussed, I guess, with the family. And I'm not saying that they have to be published.
But you'd like them to be.
Oh, I think so, because I created a certain interest in them, and I think people would like to see how this man translated his being into print or into writing, But if it can't be done, then that's the way it is.
There isn't much of a market for poetry, is there?
No, but there might be a market. Well, it's not even a market. There's not a point of having a market. I'm not trying to make money out of it. I just think there should be a historical record of what he wrote, since I've created a bit of a persona in the 1980s out of his tapes. Now, he also already had a persona in New York, and there are people you can interview about that. So it's not, it's just like a second part of his life. When he came back to Nova Scotia.
Do you think Garrett Dean was an important person?
He certainly was for people he met. I'll tell you, here's the kind of synchronicity that happened. On the day that we were getting ready to move the antiques out, the big truck, a privately owned mover, came. And he came into the house, and he was stunned by the artifacts that he saw. And he started saying, I think I know something about this place. And he says, is this that old guy who used to walking the bridge? And I said, yeah. He says, I met him a year ago. I was sitting up in, some drugstore where they have a counter, and maybe a Zeller's. And he says, this man came in, and he sat down, uninvited at my table and started to talk to me. And he said, I spent the next hour talking to him, and he says, that man knew a lot. I learned so much in that hour. I didn't know who he was, and I remember that, and now I'm here moving his antiques, and I didn't know a year ago that that's what would happen. So he accidentally came into Garrett's life again, and he gradually recognized who this man was. So for that person to say, remember a year later, that man knew a lot. Now, I don't know what Garrett talked to him about, but that's an example of the impact he had on all kinds of people who didn't know anything about him. And maybe there are people who don't even know that he lived in Dartmouth, just a person passing through. But the friends that I know with Garrett, they almost turn him into, they regard him as a saint, as a great mystic. You've talked to Reverend Eric Terrio?
Yes.
I know that his eulogy of Garrett was quite impressive. He put Garrett up there with the poet, the kind of archetypal poet who walks with the angels. I mean, I don't know if many people get that kind of eulogy. And Garrett was friends with all kinds of different ministers from different churches. Even though he talked, he didn't like discussions of morality. And another part of himself, you would think he was a devout pagan, and he probably would say he was a devout pagan. But he respected the institutions of society. And once we went to St. Peter's Church in Dartmouth at Christmas Eve, and I made an aside that wasn't too positive, and he scolded me for doing that, you know, right there in church privately. And so he said, you don't be like that in this church. And I always remembered that. But for people that I met, they were always overwhelmed and thought that their life was special because they met Garrett. And I wouldn't be surprised if the people who don't want to publish his poetry feel that sense of private connection with Garrett and almost want to preserve it.
Do you think Eric Terrio is exaggerating things when he puts him up at that height?
Oh, no. For me, Garrett, I have a book out, and I list him in there with Marsh McLuhan, and I've met a lot of great minds in this period, the last 20 years. I put him up there, and I would say that he was the greatest person, I mean, on a personal level, and he gave me my baptism. He was the greatest person that I ever met in my life, and I've been involved with a lot of different people intellectually and as an archivist. And those people I didn't get to know often on a very personal level, but I wasn't attracted to. I didn't feel I missed connecting with those people on a personal level because I felt I met the greatest poet, the Homer of the 20th century in Garrett. And not just a poet, but a person who surprised you constantly. And also the way he was so generous with his home and with people. I met people in his home that I would never meet anywhere else in society. I would probably be snobbish or I would feel inferior, depending on who they were. Yeah, but with Garrett, he was a great leveler, and everybody became unique and warm in his presence. And I don't think there's any I've never met a person like that. Maybe there are gurus who do that, and you hear about them, and they form cults. But Garrett never formed a cult, and he just was completely unique. So he was the greatest person so far that I've met, I mean, outside of my wife.
She'll like that.
Yeah.
Eric Terrio, when I talked to him, said that Garrett sought truth and beauty in everything, and that is the mark of a great poet. Do you think that's accurate?
Yes, but I think his idea of beauty wasn't a cliché beauty. I mean, often he would talk about a pile of garbage across the street and point out the beauty of that. So I don't think he had a Victorian sense of beauty or a previous century archetypal repeat of a way a poet was. He was so... What amazed me is I've interacted with a lot of famous people in the last 10 or 15 years, thanks to my radio show and other opportunities. And when I came back to see Garrett every Christmas, he always talked about ideas, talked new ideas in relation to me that year, and they were always summing up what I learned from these other people out on the road. And that always amazed me. Every year when I met Garrett, even though I hadn't talked to him for maybe 6 months, he would bring up new ideas I hadn't heard him talk about before that resonated with what I had been involved with that year. And so he was always in touch with everything that was happening the time.
So was he a mystic?
Oh, yeah, definitely a mystic. That was... You could romanticize Garrett as a mystic, but I saw him as a postmodern mystic because he didn't, if you get to know him and saw how he interacted with people, he didn't take a traditional view, or he didn't act out the traditional mystical review or mystical style. He was something you couldn't categorize, but definitely traditional mysticism, like Khalil Gibran, he talked about a lot. He would talk about them, but he would always emphasize that he was not anything special, that he was not a guru, and he had not had any special experience, though you knew he did. And often I would see him when I came to his home, and I always remember this was the first time I met him, in the second time, but the real first encounter. When we stood in the hallway for about a half hour, as he talked, his eyes kept rolling back up into his head, sort of like he was coming out of a meditative state. I later found out that's what he meant when he said, "I've been in the silence for 2 or 3 days." So because he...
Wait a minute. When he'd what?
He said, I've been in the silence for 2 or 3 days. I mean, he just said, "I've been in the silence, Bob, just a minute until I get used to you being here." And occasionally his eyes would be rolling back in his head. So he was a kind of meditator, a person who went into trance or whatever you do privately as a mystic. He obviously did that because... If you came into his presence at his home and then were sitting in the kitchen, he'd take a few minutes to sort of focus on you. Now, that happened only 2 or 3 times that I see that. But So, and he would then say that he had not talked to anybody for 2, 3, 4 days. So he didn't have any social obligations like a job or anything. So he probably did a lot of personal meditation or whatever one does in the silence.
So he called it in the silence.
Yes, I've been in the silence. I've been in the silence for a while. And he had these great phrases when he would say goodbye. He wouldn't say, if you're on the phone, he wouldn't say, okay, bye. He would go, in dreams, and that would be a sign of hanging up. And then he would never hang up first. He'd let you hang up. And he had all kinds of these amazing phrases that were his way of exiting from your presence.
Give me some others.
I can't remember. I just use the in dreams. There's none coming to my memory now. I sort of picked up on that one, and that was the one I used with him. But I heard him use different ones with different people.
Okay. Well, listen. But, go ahead, Bob. Sorry.
Yeah. So, you know, that in dreams, that's what his way of saying goodbye. He never said goodbye. You know, he just said that, and then you kind of knew it was time to go, and you hang up.
Well, Bob, I'm going to say in dreams myself. We got to go.
Listen,
okay. Thanks very much. I have the tapes. And I told Sue I would let her know when this is going to air. So I will definitely do that. And I'll probably get back to you as well just to let you know where things are going.
Right. And there is another part of another tape that Sue has for another type of Garrett. The closest to instant poetry on something called Furry Lint. If you want to get another example, Sue will get that for you.
So is that a tape? Or?
Yeah, it's on a tape. I made a four-hour show, and I included parts of Garrett. The parts of Garrett in there are really different from what the tapes you have now.
Okay,
Kelly?
Thanks very much, Bob.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.